The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Marx's Capital, Volume 1, Chapter 15, entitled Machinery and Modern Industry, is the subject this week as Andy Marshall and Andrew Kleiman return for Part 2 of the podcast. However, the three of us also discuss how capitalism deforms education and what today's education system really is and how it works. It's Wednesday, April 6th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. In 10 days, I'll reach the 7th anniversary of my foray into podcasting. That means the first episode of my previous podcast called Diet Soap that was posted on the 16th of April in 2009. And what I've noticed lately is that really popular podcasts out on the internet are usually more conversational, if not outright confessional. And that over the years, I've sort of taken up a more distanced and professional tone as I've just read information, especially at the beginning of each podcast. But in an effort to break from that regimented approach, today I thought I'd let you in on what my morning has been like. So I work from home, and as I work from home, I can spend waste too much time on social media, mostly on Facebook. And this morning I tried to multitask between editing this episode on Marx's Capital and arguing with a right-winger and a liberal on Facebook. Of the two, the argument with the liberal was more revealing. This occurred on Brendan O'Neill's Facebook page, and it was in a thread about his recent essay for Spiked Online entitled The Panama Papers, Rich Bashing Won't Fix the Crisis. So what I spent maybe an hour arguing was that while the bashing of the rich and focusing on banking shenanigans was kind of unavoidable and enjoyable, the truth was that the corruption in the banking sector was just a symptom, and blaming the rich for the problem of a systematic crisis was pretty much structurally the same as blaming the Jews. Obviously, that's a very inflammatory way to put it, and the reaction was, as you might expect it to be, but I think it's true that there's no use just blaming rich people for what's really a structural crisis. I'm not sure if it would have mattered if I said it any more gently. In any case, I'm going to put a link to the O'Neill essay in the show notes. And even though I don't really agree with O'Neill's overall politics, for instance, his opposition to welfare spending or his insistence that the lack of productive spending in the economy can be explained by referring to psychology, somehow capitalists have become risk-averse due to a lack of testicular fortitude or something. His overall abandonment of really radical change at all of that stuff I oppose, but just by being contrarian, just by kind of trying to rouse the left from its slumber by saying these inflammatory things, they're sometimes useful. They're usually interesting. It's people over at Spiked. So I'm going to link to them. And I welcome people to read the essay and to comment on it, or to read Capital, Chapter 15, And right back on that, you can find the Zero Books Facebook page. You can tweet us. We're on Twitter. And you can find my personal website and write to me through email through that. There's a contact form. Back to the usual information. The music in this episode includes Street Musicians covering Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, and Negative Land's A Nice Place to Live. The music you're listening to right now is an excerpt from Negative Land's first album entitled Negative Land. But in just a moment, you'll hear Andy, Andrew, and I discuss The Machine.
But I think we got the first section discussed pretty well. Okay, so there's a question, I think, I don't know if it's in this chapter or this section, but like there was a little bit of math going on about what happens when you have a machine for the cost of the item produced. And I don't know that I followed it completely. But it seems to me before I read this that when we're the value of the cost and value, I'm sorry, mixing this up, but the value that is the for the item, when you produce it by machine, the actual value will go down for the machine produced item, because there's less labor in it, right? But then there's this weird discussion that he has, and I'm not sure if it's this section or if it's later, that is not exactly one for one, that it goes down, you know, because there's less labor going in, because there's a certain amount
of... It takes a certain amount of labor, quite a lot actually, to make one of these machines. And the machine, maybe very slowly, does transfer value to the new product. So it's not as though you're going to lose the same amount as you've eliminated from the labor process when you buy a machine. You're still going, you know, it's not going to be one for one. That new product may even go up in cost.
If you're referring to the passage on the end of page 514, mm-hmm. beginning 515, which you weren't, you were referring to the prior paragraph, which is related. But I think what he's saying on 514, 515 is, let's imagine that you have the machine and it actually is more costly than what the capitalist used to pay the workers that have been displaced. Mm. Okay, well, he actually says just as much, but imagine it's more costly. So imagine you have a whole bunch of workers and you pay them £3,000. And imagine that you install a machine and it cost you £3,500. So it's more costly than these workers whose wages you've been able to save £3,000. So it looks like that would not be a profitable move. Marx is saying, look, it is a profitable move because you are the labor objectified is much smaller in quantity than the living labor it replaces. Mm. Okay, that's the end of that paragraph, top paragraph from 515. Mm. What Marx is saying is, not so much profitability, but in terms of value. Okay, the value of what gets produced is going to be less, even if the machine costs more. So it's not really an issue of profitability. I got that wrong. But it's an issue of the machinery reducing the value or cost of commodities, even if the expenditure on the machine exceeds the wages that are saved. So you have some additional constant capital. You have less variable capital. Even if the additional constant capital minus the saved variable capital, even if that's a positive sum, so you're spending more, it's still going to reduce the value of the commodities because you're saving on labor, and that's because the capitalist does not pay for all of the labor time. There's a portion of the working day is unpaid.
Mm.
I think that that's what he's getting at there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Why he's saying it is a little bit unclear.
Wait a minute. It's going to – are you talking about the total – you're talking about per commodity, right?
Yes, per commodity.
Wouldn't the main reason be that the commodity would be cheapened? It would be because the machine, even though it costs as much as the workers, was going to outproduce them? Or are we assuming that the cost was equal to the amount of workers it would take to produce the same amount of commodities?
Well, Marx is working with the same cost. In other words, Marx's example is 3,000 additional expenditure for constant capital for the machine, 3,000 less variable capital for all these displaced workers. So he's saying, you know, the capitalist cost, you know, that they actually pay is the same overall.
So the workers, the number of workers that you're replacing are the number of workers that could produce the same amount of commodity in a working day as the machine does?
No.
Okay, well, that's why my point. I mean, if that's not the case, if the machine is producing more, wouldn't that fact alone cheapen the commodity in comparison?
Let's just say the answer is changed and it is yes. It's the same amount of commodities for the same people. You still have something that is inspiring the fetishism of the capitalists there, because they're able to sell their competitors across the water, you know, doing it all by hand or whatever, and you're able to sell yours for, let's say, the same price. I mean, the value of that item is actually less because you did it by machine or something.
Right, yeah. But I'm assuming that you are charging exactly what the commodity is worth in my head here, which you wouldn't be doing.
And then I can see why if you're producing more of that, all of a sudden you can still increase the profitability.
The question of what they sell it for isn't even entering my head. The question is, is the value in the commodity produced by machine less than the value of the workers producing the commodity?
Right. Okay. Doug, I think you're doing the same thing that Marx is doing by a different method.
Okay.
You're doing it to, you know, down on a per commodity level. Right. He's dealing with totals.
Okay.
I think that's the only difference. Mm. Okay. So if you were to think about your example and then multiply it and assume let's say you assume it's the same amount of stuff being produced. Okay. So take your example and assume that instead of, okay, well, they got machines so they produce more, let's assume that they don't produce more. Let's say the market's limited. So they produce exactly the same amount of stuff, the factory. It costs exactly the same. The only difference is more of an expenditure on constant capital, less of an expenditure on variable capital. So they've gotten rid of a bunch of workers. The point is that the total value, the same amount of stuff, will be less. And that's because even though the C plus V is the same, there's going to be less labor added. Okay. Now that wouldn't you wouldn't have that result if there were no surplus value. In other words, if the workers were paid, if there were no unpaid labor time, if all labor time were paid, you wouldn't have that result. So Marx is saying you're getting that result that even when their monetary expenditure overall is unchanged and they produce the same amount of stuff, okay, the total value of these commodities goes down, and that's by virtue of the fact that some of that value before was surplus value. Okay, and that portion is being eliminated, and that's reducing the value of the total value of the products.
Right. You're exploiting less labor.
Yeah.
I mean, I think when you talk about paid or not paid, it tended to confuse me a little bit, because I was thinking that the amount that, I mean, we can eliminate paid or not paid because we've already eliminated the wages from the equation, because the machine costs is the same as the wages. So the wages aren't really where the difference is. It's the amount of labor that's being exploited beyond wages, the surplus labor. And that's just my confusion, I think, because I tend to think that somehow wages, you know, that number is somehow in the product. And it is, but it's, anyway, I get confused about wages sometimes. But and I wish I could express, I know in my head what I'm trying to say. I'm not saying it. But
right. I think you're saying the same thing. Here's what I'm trying to say. Okay, imagine you got the workers, they're paid $3,000. Okay, and there was no surplus value. Okay, and you didn't have a machine. So then the total value of whatever stuff was produced, that would be $3,000. Okay, now imagine you got just the machine and not the workers, and the machine costs $3,000. Okay, and imagine it all gets used up. Okay, but there's no workers. So that's $3,000. Cost. Okay, there wasn't any surplus value before. There isn't any surplus value now. The cost of the value of the commodities is $3,000 the way it was before. That wouldn't be a saving in terms of labor time. That wouldn't be a labor saving technical change.
Right.
Okay, but what tends to happen is you got workers with you spend $3,000 on them. The rate of surplus value is 100%. So 6,000 in new value. So the stuff originally had a value of 6,000. Now you get rid of the workers, you put in the machines. You don't have any workers, but you got 3,000 in machine costs that get passed on. So the value of the products is 3,000. Right. 3,000, not 6,000. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's basically what he's getting at.
Yeah, yeah. I understand. I just somehow the details get me, depending on which sides of the picture you're looking at, I can get confused. Because I'm not good at math is what it is.
Well, no, and that's what they say. If you have a math equation in your book, you're going to have that many fewer people doing it. But that's why I wanted to point it out, because it was the math gets really tricky. Because you have to really think the whole process and not just individual savings, but I mean, and obviously from a labor perspective, you can see like the machine pumping out stuff and not a lot of people working, but it gets kind of screwy because even right after that, your machine could displace workers, drop the labor, the cost that it costs for labor to the point where now no longer it's, you know, a better choice to have the machine, but the machine could be useful in another country, like he's shortly talking about, you know, on 516, where the 16th and 17th centuries, machines were invented in Germany for use exclusively in Holland, just as French inventions in the 18th century exploited only in England. You start producing things in one place, but so I'm thinking now like China or whatever, you know, you reproduce these machines there. The labor is so cheap there that they wouldn't use those same machines or whatever, not in the same way.
Yeah, yeah, that part was really, really complicated. It's like you suddenly realize that he makes it clear that a machine that would be profitable in one part of the world won't be for various reasons having to do with the labor force in another part of the world. And so you can have machines built in Germany but not used there because they're, you know, they're not profitable if they're used in Germany, but they are in England or what have you.
Right. And so laws become really important. Like, you know, I mean, I know he's been discussing it, you know, the factory acts and stuff, but they become really important as to whether you can even use those machines profitably or not. I know, like in Columbus, you know, just like getting those big companies to come in, you know, it seemed like a really great idea or something, and they were spending a lot of money to get those companies to come in because of in the long term, you're going to make a lot of money off of those, you know, big companies or whatever. In the same way, analogously.
Well, I mean, it goes to show you why, like you were saying, like why you can have all these machines built in China, but hardly used there at all. I mean, it doesn't, when it comes to iPads and things, it's not a good analogy, but you could, I'm sure there are parts of the world where machines for production are made but never used.
Right, right. I mean, I don't know. I have other examples. Like I have an engineer friend who works on cement factories, and he ends up working in all these weird places around the world because they're building stuff now. You know, they're using cement. But that job you know, as the, I mean, so in the invention of the factory creates this class of engineers too. I mean, that, so that's another class of people you see kind of on the rise, and that's another person you're going to have to pay. But obviously, like, paying them is less than having the, you know, not have the machine on in some places in the world or something, right?
Right. What's interesting, most interesting to me is in this conversation is to think about how different laws about, you know, trade and such are compelled to come into being by the material conditions in the world. I mean, not that they're absolutely going to be, not that they absolutely have to be just because the material conditions are correct, but there is a drive to implement, you know, so-called free trade based on the demands that the material conditions are making. But those material conditions are not, you know, just where we naturally grow corn or something. They have to do with the social conditions in different parts of the world and the way the workforce is put together and who does what and all that kind of thing.
Schools is a relatively recent phenomenon for everybody to have to go to school. And that was one of the questions in the background. It wasn't discussed here, but I didn't know if either of you had anything you wanted to, you know, had any ideas as to, like schooling itself is a different thing. I don't know if I'm in the right section.
It's an interesting question. Like, before capitalism came around and basically degraded children's education, as it's pointed out in section 3, that the impact of machinery, you know, of the factory system was to make a whole generation of illiterates. But it's interesting to ask, well, where were children learning and how were children learning before this? So that there was a standard in place that people were outraged by the impact of the factory system. And I don't know the answer to that. I would imagine that there were, you know, there was Bible reading, you know, I'm that kind of thing.
I just read a really fascinating book that kind of discussed that, and it was a different parts of the United States. It was mainly dealing with the United States. The different parts of the United States, learning was very important, and it almost seems like every other part of the United States started to kind of compete with that part. Like, but it was Bible. It was Bible based, and it was a way of like according to like the South in America, it was a way that the Northerners were trying to dominate the Southerners with their, you know, smart talk and whatever. There's a certain class of people, the higher class, they wanted them to learn. They didn't want everybody to learn, you know? And so there's this kind of everybody must learn here in this chapter, in this section of this chapter. And it just made me wonder, like, you know, what the conditions were. Sorry to interject that, but was a question.
It's a good question. Why was there outrage? What were the standards for education before the introduction of factory work, which took all the kids in? I mean, it wasn't just that they were illiterate. They were also, you know, dying in droves and sickly and, you know, all of it. But that was part of it. And so they tried to sort of pretend to solve the problem by implementing a public education and requiring kids to be educated before they could work in the factory, at least for 30 days. But it, of course, that didn't take, as Marx describes it, because the demands of the factory, you know, were such that they would just disrupt basically whatever education was going on. You know, you'd spend 30 days learning and 6 months working in the factory, and it would just undo everything that had happened in the classroom. That problem goes away as the day is shortened and the approach is no longer to extend the working day, but to intensify labor. It doesn't entirely go away, but I mean, it's no longer a major concern.
I mean, the opiates, right, were one significant example of like something where the women were going to work. So now nobody was kind of watching the kids, and instead of watching them, they were giving them opiates. I mean, that's the takeaway that I got from reading it, and I was just like, kind of like, wow, you know? They were prolonging the day, but then also there was the factory acts, which were shortening the day. I don't think this is in this section. I don't know. That was interesting how it was almost beneficial to the capitalist to shorten the day in some circumstances, and others it wasn't, but...
Right,
because now they're intensifying. Well, the manufacturer it had this ability of focusing people more, because you can imagine if you're working 12 hours, now you're working 10, you're paying a little bit more attention. Where you look and what each machine machine factory has different conditions. Some could be great, right, and then others somewhere else could be not so great, and depending on the thing that they're producing and otherwise.
I was thinking about this factory inspector report where the teacher doesn't know how to spell her name.
Right.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking is, you know, this is a modern phenomenon. I mean, William Shakespeare spelled his name lots of different ways, you know.
Right.
It's not a very germane point, what I was thinking of, but...
Yeah, well, it goes back to the question of like what. My question is to and Andy's question is like, what were the conditions in education before the factory came in, and how did the factory's own demands shape the way they conceived of what was an adequate education?
I think it's a very good question. I don't know the answer. I mean, I know a little bit about the situation in the States. But not much about that either. You know, I mean, it is a bigger deal to us now than it was back then. I mean, we need more education because we don't get education for instance, we don't get the kind of technical education that people growing up on farms would get. You know, they would go out with their father, uncle, older brother, and so forth, and they, you know, they would learn farming. With machine production, you lose that, and you get people who just don't need any of that education at all from the standpoint of capital. Mm-hmm. So they don't need education in order to do work. And basically, I mean, capitalism has never thought it, you know, the people who run the system have never thought it to be a major requirement that people learn anything, except insofar as they're going to need that education to run the system or whatever. And that's why we have such unequal education. We have what more than half of the population of the U.S. has graduated college. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're comparing apples and oranges there. You got the Harvard, Yales, you got the Ivy League on the one hand. You got some really, really bad schools on the other. People come out, you know, semi-literate and so forth.
Mm.
So what has happened in the United States in particular, but other countries as well, nowadays we put so much stress on education because it's viewed as a road to upward mobility.
Yeah.
Especially the United States, not so much Germany. The United Kingdom is kind of an intermediate case. This is not the kind of thing that Marx was talking about. He was just talking about, you know, ignorance and, you know, his just his abhorrence at the total ignorance of great numbers of people. I don't think the facts that he's describing are regarded as so abhorrent nowadays. What might be regarded as very abhorrent is, gee, these people didn't make it through 12 years of school, didn't make it to college, and so forth. But the fact that they don't know anything, well, what do they need that for? I think that's still a very common way of thinking.
He's throwing in the fact that they don't know how to spell their own name or have no education alongside of, you know, their illness in general. It's just a matter of being fully human to him to be educated in a certain sense or to be informed or to have enough understanding to have some grip on the world, I think. It makes it easy not to be your own person when you don't know what's going on.
Right. That's what he's talking about, yeah. You know, but like, he's Marx, right?
Right.
he's a dangerous revolutionary, you know.
Right.
You know, when President Obama and all these other people talk about, you know, we need education, blah blah blah. That's not what they're really talking about.
Right. Mm-hmm. No. Right.
Yeah.
I know very well, having kids, what you're talking about. My son is just about done getting his high school diploma and associate's degree at the same time, and he's looking to go to school, you know, university somewhere, and major in computer science. And we're thinking about it not in terms of his education like Marx would think. We're talking about, like, this is an investment into a career.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so he wants to go to a school in Seattle, out of state, or he was thinking about that. And I said, well, look, first of all, we can't afford out-of-state tuition, but if you get the loans for it, you're going to be in massive debt, just massive debt when you're done. And if you, and not all of your credits are going to transfer, and it'll take longer, so you're going to spend more. If you go in-state, you're going to be able to get through in 2 years, and it will cost you almost, in comparison, nothing, but, you know, not very much. So strictly in terms of investment, it's better for you to stay in state. And he's like, well, but the school in Seattle is, you know, a top five school. And I was like, yeah, I don't know what that even means. So, you know, I don't know why that matters. And I was being very capitalist, I guess, or very much inside the capitalist system when I was thinking that way. But
it's very complex because, like, you kind of have to spend money to make money. So, like, I was raised to be very efficient with my money, right? So what you just spelled out totally made sense, and I'm nodding the whole way. But if you go to those top – let's just say it's a legitimate top five school, and that's not the school selling itself. If you go to the legitimate top five school, I mean, half of what you're doing in college is making associations. You make the right associations with the right people. I mean, it has almost nothing to do with education, But it's sort of being in the club, and I know we're kind of getting away from.
Yeah, we had that part of the conversation too, and I said, yeah, you can do that at the graduate level.
Mm-hmm.
An undergraduate, I just don't see it that making any sense, you know. But
yeah, get your feet wet in the school thing.
Yeah,
in the first. Yeah.
But what do you think, Andrew? Any opinion on that?
You know, having worked in the industry for really 30 years,
mm-hmm.
I have a lot of opinions of U.S. higher education.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm just disgusted and horrified by the whole thing. But no, I mean. Yeah, I mean these calculations are financial, and what happens is, you know, in the end, it has been the case for decades now that the gap between the pay of the more educated and the pay of the less educated has been widening. Right. And so it has proven in general to be a good financial investment for people to get themselves, to get their kids, get degrees.
Mm-hmm.
How much education they get is another matter. Mm-hmm. Nobody seems to care about that. You know, the people who are actually buying degrees, and, you know, I would see this all the time. I mean, basically, there's all this like pressure to cut out the middleman. Why do anything more than require them to just show up? You know, they're there to get a degree. They're not there to like learn stuff,
right?
You know, the employers don't care about that. They want the degree, with the exception of some fields like, you know, accounting, or, you know, you're talking about a master's or a professional degree. But at the undergraduate level, you know, nobody goes in and learn and applies their skills that they learned in school, you know, in the workplace in any direct sense.
Right.
So there's this huge gap, or there has been this huge gap. You get this immensely expensive system of education as a result. They're able to take a big cut of it, you know? Yeah. And so tuitions just keep going up and up and up. And why do they go up? It's not like the faculty that are getting this money, and it's not like they're employing so many additional people in the faculty. The administration just expands, because they're doing more to steal each other's students,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing more to advance their careers, so they need bigger departments. And the whole thing has just become incredibly expensive, but everybody's happy. The students and their parents are happy, because even with the huge expenses, as long as they make it through, they're still ahead of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And the colleges are very happy, because they're skimming like crazy. The employers, you know, don't care. They just want to say, okay, look, this person will probably be good labor power, because, you know, they'll show up to work. They showed up to you know, 4 years of nonsense that they had no interest in. They'll be able to work for 30 years in a job they got no interest in. You know, and the only people who like really hate it are faculty of the old school, who you know would want to like advance knowledge or something. You know, they're not doing it by means of the students and so forth. But even people like that, and I'm one of them, say, well, you know, otherwise we wouldn't have jobs. You know,
what about this question of like a computer science or economics, say, but computer science person coming out of a top five school as compared to a top 25 school? Do you think that financially, that degree from the at an undergraduate level is just going to matter a whole lot as compared?
I don't know. That would depend on the field, and it would depend on probably the particular year. It's really hard to say. I can't answer that question.
Yeah.
I know that people in computer science have been having, you know, difficulties landing good jobs and so forth. But it that's cyclical. But no, the whole system is an incredible farce, and what's fueling it is the fact that everybody from the right to the left has bought into this so-called equal opportunity notion.
You mean equal opportunity to have a purchase degree that will give them a better job?
That's what they're in favor of. I mean, it used to be that like people on the left, the liberals and so forth, were concerned about securing certain equality of outcomes. And the left basically in the past generation or a little bit more has totally given that up in the United States. You know, so they buy into equal opportunity. And so if everybody has this chance at a college degree, that's equal opportunity, and then everything's fine. So all the arguments are about equal opportunity. That's degrading to the whole idea of education anyway, that it's just viewed as an opportunity vehicle. Mm. I mean, I work at a university, and the university's, you know, magazine, the one that they, you know, pass around to prospective donors and alumni and stuff, it is called Opportunitas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is not what Marx is talking about when he's complaining about the state of education for the factory workers, you know, the child labor. But it's very, very, it's just really hard to translate his discussion of education into the modern U.S. system. Of course, he's talking about elementary education, and we're talking about higher levels too. But no, there definitely has been. I remember there definitely has been in this relatively short space the whole idea of securing equality of a certain sort on the left that's gone away, and they have subscribed to this notion of equal opportunity.
Yeah.
And it's a complete farce, you know, because the fact that you know, one person's got a college education and another one's got a college education, they're not equally educated, and their prospects in life are not the same because there is such humongous differentiation in higher education.
Right.
Maybe not between the top five school, the you know, in the top five and the top 25, but you know, once you move down a bit, you're talking about completely different education. I mean, my students got a completely different education, not just not as good, it completely different, qualitatively incommensurable with someone going to an Ivy League school.
What do you think the main quality difference would be between the two?
The people going to Ivy League schools are being educated to be leaders of society.
Right.
Well, people that I was teaching were not being educated at a level where they were learning those things. It's just entirely different education. It really we're talking about incommensurable things to say that they're both college graduates. You know, that they really are two different systems. You know, one thing you have to understand is because of the humongously high costs of higher education, in most of this country, students work. And they don't just do part-time jobs, 10, 15 hours. My students were primarily full-time employees who went to school. Even if they went full-time, they went as their tertiary activity after their work and social life.
Right.
And partly they were working for the money that they needed to pay the tuition. Partly that's the way they actually got, you know, into careers, is by having some, you know, prior work experience. That's how they made their contacts. And so the students don't study, because you can't work full time, you know, go to school full time, and have a full social life, as most of them want to do all at the same time. Something's got to give. And what generally gives is any engagement with the, you know, educational material outside of class. 10, 15 years ago, the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is kind of like the industry publication, they reported on a survey, and this is not new by any means. It was 10, 15 years ago. The average amount of study time per student,
mm-hmm.
Was something like 5 hours a week.
Wow.
Okay. You know, it's recommended that, you know, if you have a 3-hour class, 3 hours contact with the professor per week, you study 6 hours. So if you take 5 classes, that would be 30 hours. So, you know, the average was something like 3.5, 5 hours, something like that. And that includes doing all kinds of assignments, studying for tests and so forth. So it's basically they're showing up.
5 hours of study of homework, not per class, but overall for all their classes.
Yeah. So it works out to an hour per course per week or less. It was something like that.
Well,
that was a US-wide average. Yeah.